From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. In the film Flight, Denzel Washington plays a pilot who saves scores of passengers with a heroic mid-air maneuver, but turns out to have a serious substance abuse problem. Today, director Robert Zemeckis says to prepare, Denzel watched YouTube videos of drunks.
He would come to me and say, you know, I watched this one where this guy was trying to put his shoe on. He was working on this for like, you know, 10 minutes. He was out there on the street and he couldn't get his foot in his shoe. So he was, you know, he was looking at the physicality of what it is that he was going to do.
Flight is now out on DVD. And we'll hear our 2008 interview with Denzel Washington. He says he was named after his father.
My mother would say Denzel, and both of us would show up.
So he became Denzel. And David Edelstein reviews the creepy new film Stoker. That's coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies. Terry Gross returns Monday. Our first guest, Robert Zemeckis, is a Hollywood veteran who directed the film Flight, which earned 2 Oscar nominations. His other films include Romancing the Stone, 3 Back to the Future films, Forrest Gump, Contact, and Castaway. He also directed the innovative cartoon and live-action movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and has recently worked with cutting-edge motion capture technology in the films The Polar Express and Beowulf. Flight, which is now out on DVD, stars Denzel Washington as an airline pilot with substance abuse problems who performs brilliantly in a mid-air emergency to save scores of passengers, though 6 people die in the plane's crash landing. Afterward, the pilot struggles with his addiction and faces the threat that he'll be held accountable for his drinking and drug abuse and blamed for the crash despite his heroic landing. I spoke with Zemeckis in November, and we began with a clip from Flight, in which the pilot and his co-pilot are fighting to regain control of their plane as it plunges toward the ground.
This is Southjet 227. We're in an uncontrolled dive, and we got a jam stabilizer or something.
Oh, Lord, we're coming out 7,000. I see nothing but acid.
When I say I want you to retract the flaps, retract the gear, trim us nose down, okay?
Trim down? What are you going to do?
When I tell you I want you to push these forward, full throttle, you got me? Okay, when I tell you...
Wait, sir, what are we doing? Why would I trim down?
We're going to roll it, okay?
What do you mean roll it?
We got to do something to stop this dive. Here we go. I've got control.
Well, Robert Zemeckis, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, I think the thought of air crashes holds a special terror for everybody who's been in an airplane, which is most of us these days. You are a pilot yourself. There's this kind of calm that pilots seem to have, or at least that I imagine them having. You know, when I read Tom Wolfe's book, The Right Stuff, about military pilots, never a moment's panic. You're just always focused on the task at hand.
Yeah, and what it is that I think that you're taught to do is to, you know, just work the problem. And I think when situations happen that are irregular, what does happen is that your training sort of just automatically kicks in, and you start to go through those checklists and start doing all those things that you've been, going over and over in your head, and you just start to go into that mode.
Did you or Denzel Washington listen to, you know, cockpit recordings of, you know, of pilots that were in crises and jams up in the air?
You know, I don't know if Denzel did, but I certainly did, because I know that you can go online and hear any of the sort of what they call the black box recordings from airline incidents. And you can actually go online, I guess, and listen to, you know, pilots talking to controllers live all day long. But yes, I listened to some incidents just to get in a sense of what the tone of the pilot's voice would be. And some of them were pretty calm, but then some of them, you know, you could hear the panic in their voice, that's for sure.
The effects on this are pretty amazing. I mean, you completely buy that this is happening, and you see it from many angles. And you did this on a relatively small budget for this kind of thing, at 31 million bucks?
Yes,
I'm sure there's a long, complicated answer here, but how do you make it so real?
The short answer is I really pay a lot of attention to keeping the point of view of all this action coming from the place of character, keeping the audience with the main characters. So we've set up basically these 4 people, these 2 flight attendants and the pilot and the co-pilot. We see this incident basically from their point of view, and, you know, not try to start introducing panicking passengers or that sort of thing, and keep them basically as atmosphere, keep the drama with the main characters.
It's not a spoiler to note that the pilot, Denzel Washington, whose name is Whip Whitaker, has problems. I mean, he's a substance abuser. He drinks alcohol and takes other drugs. We see this in the opening scene, and that sets up the story. I thought we'd listen to a clip here where this is after... after the crash, and 6 people died, 2 crew members and four passengers, but everybody else survived, which was you know, due to this captain's remarkable maneuver in the air to bring the plane down. And this is a meeting where he's sitting down at a restaurant and kind of discovering what a serious situation he might be in. He's meeting with an old friend, a union representative and an old Navy buddy who is played by Bruce Greenwood. And he has brought an attorney who's played by Don Cheadle. And they're talking about what these guys are going to be facing. We'll hear Denzel Washington, the pilot, speaking first.
So why do we need a lawyer from Chicago?
He who specializes in criminal negligence.
Criminal negligence.
Mm-hmm.
Death demands responsibility. Six dead on that plane. Someone has to pay.
I flew the plane inverted. That means upside down. You have any idea what that's like?
I do. I heard the black box recordings last night.
Oh, you heard those? Are you a pilot?
No.
Then you don't know what they're talking about. All right, let's cut to the chase. Just tell me what it is I need to know, Charlie.
The NTSB GO team also collects blood, hair, and skin samples. An initial report shows that you had alcohol in your system.
Mm. Thank you. So that didn't mean anything. A couple of beers the night before the flight.
This toxicology report states that you were drunk. And if it is proven that your intoxication was the cause of the death of the four passengers, now we're going to look at four counts of manslaughter. That could be life in prison.
And that's Don Cheadle speaking with Denzel Washington and Bruce Greenwood in the film Flight, directed by our guest Robert Zemeckis. How did Denzel Washington prepare for that role, or how did you help him?
Well, you know, Denzel he's very, very focused and he's very prepared. And the only thing that we spoke about as far as levels of intoxication were, you know, he kind of had his own guide of what he was going to do. And he never really was specific, you know, with me about it, but he kind of gave me a sense of where he was going to be, like, you know, performing like he's really, really drunk or he's just got sort of a slight buzz on kind of a thing. One thing he did tell me that he did do, though, is he watched a lot of YouTube videos of drunks. And I guess you can go online and just watch drunks. But he would come to me and say, you know, I watched this one where this guy was trying to put his shoe on. And he was working on this for like, you know, 10 minutes to get this shoe on. He was out there on the street and he couldn't get his foot in his shoe. And so he was, you know, he was looking at the physicality of what it is he was going to do. But I think basically what he and I spoke about were the character's level of denial. That's what I think you're ultimately seeing in this performance. And that's what I think he did so brilliantly in his portrayal.
You grew up on the south side of Chicago in a working class family, right?
That's correct.
I read that you heard on the Johnny Carson show that there was such a thing as film school and decided
to
apply.
That's true. That's true. That's very true. Well, right, because I had no idea. I mean, the story is I was watching the Johnny Carson show, and his guest that night was Jerry Lewis. And I remember Johnny saying, "So, Jerry, I understand you're teaching school." And Jerry said, "That's right. I'm teaching cinema at the USC School of Cinema." And I heard School of Cinema. I never thought anything like that even existed. And I remember, you know, literally jumping up to my feet in the living room and thinking, my God, a school to learn how to make movies. And so then I went on this kind of quest to get into the USC Film School, which I ultimately was fortunate enough to do.
Was it hard to get in?
Well, it was very hard to get in. It was hard. I mean, you know, USC is a very, 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 academically driven school. You have to have like a 5.0 grade point average to get in. It always was that way. And I was in a strange situation because you also had to submit work to the film school. So I had been making these small films, and I sent a portfolio of my work to the film school, and I got this letter that accepted me into the film school, but I wasn't accepted into the university because my grades weren't good enough. So and in an impassioned phone call, I got on the phone with my evaluator and promised that I would go to summer school, and I'd get the grades up, and I would do everything I needed to do, and I think I I think she heard all the sort of passion in my voice, and she said, "Oh, okay, I'll let you in. I'll accept you, but you got to go to summer school and you got to get these grades up." And I did do that.
You made a couple of early films. I Want to Hold Your Hand, which is about some young women trying to get in to see the Beatles, and mm-hmm. Used Cars, which were critical but not commercial successes. And the big breakout film, I guess, for you was Back to the Future, which you wrote with your friend Bob Gale. You know, it's a fun film because it's about time travel, but it's really about these relationships, right? About this guy going and meeting his parents when they were teenagers.
Right. Bob and I were kicking around the idea, and Bob said one day, "I wonder if I would have been my father's friend if I were in high school with him." And we were thinking about our relationships with our fathers, and he said that, and he said, "Yeah." And then sort of think, "Yeah, wouldn't it be interesting if a teenage kid went back in time and met his parents as teenagers?" And that was the germ of the idea.
I read that the studios were nervous about it because it was a little too soft for some studios that were doing, you know, a lot of racy stuff, except for Disney, who thought it was a little too hardcore because a guy kisses his mom.
Right. They were worried about the Oedipal implications. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I have a very, very wonderful file of rejection letters from every studio passing on Back to the Future. Kept them all.
And the amazing thing is you get it funded and you shoot 5 weeks with Eric Stoltz in the lead role, right? And then had to reverse course. What happened?
Well, it was it's being an inexperienced director. Eric is a magnificent actor, but the comedy sensibilities of what I was doing and his sensibility as an actor just weren't working. He wasn't understanding where the humor was that I was seeing in the piece. Now, you know, it's my responsibility because I cast Eric, and I didn't do it for the right reasons, if you know what and I'm about to explain what that is. And that is that I was ordered by the studio to start the movie on a specific day. And basically I was told, if you don't start it on this day, we're not going to make the movie because we want it out for the summer. And the actor I really wanted was Michael J. Fox, but he wasn't available. So I thought, okay, I can make this movie work with Eric. And, it had nothing to do with Eric's ability, but I wasn't seeing the movie working. And so I assembled all the film that I had and I ran it for Steven. And I said, I don't think this is working. And he said, "You're right, it's not working." And so we went to the studio and said, "We want to reshoot." The head of the studio at the time literally said to me, "Sir," he said, "you are insane." He said, "You are insane." And I guess I just sort of shrugged. But, they backed my decision and allowed me to go and reshoot those 5 weeks and cast Michael J. And he worked literally 24 hours a day, working all day on his TV series. And we shot everything with him at night, and he never slept. And we went back and reshot all those weeks of shooting.
We're speaking with Robert Zemeckis. He directed the new film Flight, starring Denzel Washington. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is Robert Zemeckis. He's directed the new film Flight, starring Denzel Washington. We can't talk about all of your films, or we'd be here all day, but I did want to bring up this other memory from one that's a memorable film. And rather than introduce it, let's just play it. Let's just hear this moment.
Cigars, cigarettes, Eddie Valiant.
Betty?
Long time no see.
What are you doing here?
Work's been kind of slow since cartoons went to color. But I still got it, Eddie. Boop, boop, be-doop.
Yeah, you still got it.
Bring back a memory?
Yeah, that's Betty Boop in glorious black and white.
That, of course, is from Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Mae Questel played Betty Boop, and the detective Eddie Valiant is played by Bob Hoskins. I mean, this was a really remarkable film, and you know, a lot of people remember it, I bet, as being amazing, and probably it's long enough ago that they don't remember it so well. I mean, this was where we have these cartoon characters who are toons, people who are these creatures in 1947 Los Angeles and kind of live in a seedy part of town and interact in live action with real characters. This was the first time anybody had done this. And I know there's probably a long, complicated answer to this too, but how did you make it look so real in 1988?
Well, there were two artists, I guess, and one rule that we violated. One, I had a magnificent director of animation, Richard Williams, who was a very rebellious expatriate Canadian who lived in London, and he was just a great animator. And Ken Ralston, who was the effects supervisor at ILM. And what Ken Ralston was able to do is he was able to come up with, devise a way to put like this three-dimensional painting on each cell of animation that would match the lighting that we did in the set to give the cartoon characters the same sort of feel of the actual practical lighting that were on the human characters. And then Richard Williams was, you know, I said to him, I said, well, you know, what's never been done in these animation live action movies is that they've never moved the camera. I mean, if you look at the scenes in Mary Poppins or in Pete's Dragon or any of those, they always lock the camera off. And he said, yeah, well, that, you know, it's be so difficult to draw the different changes of perspective, and would they feel like they're floating, and all these rules about you can never move the camera. And he said, but let's do it anyway. Let's move the camera. And so in all these scenes with the cartoon characters, I just shot the movie like I would any live action movie. And the animators actually found that it worked better by having the camera moving, that they were able to actually give more life to the cartoon characters and have them feel like they were more integrated into the actual two-dimensional set. So it was that. It was like doing something that no one ever had ever done before, which gives it that sort of ability to suspend your disbelief about this whole kind of weird thing that you're looking at.
So you'd shoot the live-action scenes first, and if
yes.
You had a cartoon that would later be throwing something in the real world, like a plate or a cup, you'd have to figure out a way to make the plate or cup
right.
move.
But then later we'd go back and animate and back the animation into the live-action, we call the background plate.
But Bob Hoskins had to imagine who he was talking to. It was a voice, but he had to just, hallucinate a rabbit?
Right. Well, Charlie Fleischer was the voice of Roger Rabbit. And then I had these rubber dolls made to scale of the cartoon characters, and I would place them in the set, and we would rehearse the scene, and I would walk around holding the rabbit by its ears, bouncing around the set. And Bob would find places in the set where I would move the rabbit, and he would then move his eyes to those areas and remember where they were, and then he would focus them on a point in space because he couldn't look at the wall or a target out of frame, because then the camera would see that he would be looking through the cartoon character and it would destroy the illusion. So it was a lot of work, but the secret to the blend between animation and live action working was the performances of the live action characters. They're the ones that make the illusion work. That's why it works so much, so well in this movie, as opposed to, say, watching a Frosted Flakes commercial with
right.
Tony the Tiger and some kid actors, and you kind of look at it and go, okay, I get the gimmick, but it doesn't really look true.
You've always been interested in changing movie technology. I mean, you did a lot of stuff with motion capture, Polar Express, Beowulf. Do you think digital technology has sort of fundamentally changed movie making? I mean, even in films that really don't involve special effects?
Oh, yeah, but that's because everything always did from day one. I mean, you know, you can go back and see how, you know, in the final years of the silent cinema, where the art of cinema storytelling was so magnificent, and then when they invented the microphone and sound, everything got really static. And it all had to be reinvented again. And same when color came in. And when they invented the Steadicam, every movie had a chase up and down a staircase, you know. So what we do with these new technologies is we overuse them and we call attention to them because there's just so much fun to have. And then we learn how to use them in the way that all tools of cinema should be used, which is to make them invisible. So now I don't think you can even tell when a director is using a Steadicam. If he's really good at his job, the camera movement won't cause attention to itself. So, yeah, I think that, some of the digital stuff that we're doing now, especially in editing, I find that there's editing for what I call no reason. You know, we just edit to edit. And I think we do that in films now because we can. But we'll get that out of our system and then something else will be there that'll be the new technology of the month.
Well, Robert Zemeckis, it's been fun. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Oscar-winning director Robert Zemeckis. His film Flight is now out on DVD. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Celebrating Fresh Air's 25 years, the Neubauer Family Foundation salutes WHYY and listeners like you, committed to new ideas and civilized conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Angie's List, providing reviews of local contractors, dentists, electricians, and mechanics to keep the consumer informed. More at angieslist.com. From Charles Schwab, providing retirement options for a tomorrow that is wide open. Learn more at schwab.com/retirement. And from Road Scholar, offering travel adventures for people who love to learn at roadscholar.org. Think outside the tour. This is NPR.
Coming up, Denzel Washington tells us about playing everything from a gangster to a doctor, a corrupt cop, and Malcolm X. He earned his 6th Oscar nomination for his role in Flight, which is now out on DVD. And David Edelstein reviews Stoker, a creepy new film about a grieving widow and her teenage daughter who are visited by a lecherous uncle. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies. Terry Gross returns Monday. Denzel Washington earned a 6th Academy Award nomination for his portrayal of an airline pilot with substance abuse problems in the film Flight, which is now out on DVD. He's taken the Oscar home twice, for his starring role in Training Day and for his supporting role in Glory. Terry interviewed Washington a few years back after the release of The Great Debaters, which he both directed and starred in. Set in the early 30s, it's about a debating team at a small African-American college in the segregated South preparing to break the color line by taking on an Ivy League debating team. It's based on a true story. One of the members of that team was James Farmer Jr., who helped organize the Freedom Riders and co-founded CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality. Washington played the debating team coach and mentor, a contrast to some other characters he's played, like the corrupt cop in Training Day or the drug kingpin in American Gangster, bad guys who are anything but role models. Terry asked him about that.
Does it affect you differently when you're off the set, if you're playing, you know, a drug kingpin who will willingly kill somebody if he thinks it's necessary, versus, you know, a professor whose, like, mission is training his students to be winning debaters? I mean, that's such two different kinds of personalities. Does it change what you take home with you at night?
You know, I read a book years ago, Cagney by Cagney, written by James Cagney. And he talked about, you know, it's his job. He's at the studio, you do your job, you know, you shut your door and you go, get in your car and go home. I guess it does. I couldn't tell you what it is because I'm not thinking about it. But basically, well, it's different in the case of directing because you don't ever turn off. You're working all the time. But when I finished American Gangster, I was done with it. I didn't, you know, think about going into the drug business. I don't know. You know, it's a job. And I've been at it a long time. And I know how to do my job, I think. But no, I don't think I carry it around too much. I hope.
Well, we should hear a clip from American Gangster. And you play a drug kingpin in Harlem in this, and you've brought up your family from the South, and you've basically made your brothers into foot soldiers for your operation. And one of your brothers, played by Chiwetel Ejiofor, is kind of so kind of taken by like the money and what he could do with it. So he's wearing this outfit with, you know, like a, it's the early 70s with a big collar and a big hat, and you think it's like much too flashy. And mm-hmm. In this scene, you're explaining why that's a problem.
What is that you got on?
What's man?
Yeah, that. What you got on?
It's a very, very, very nice suit.
That's a very, very, very nice suit. That's a clown suit. That's a costume
on, man.
With a big sign on it that says arrest me. You understand? You're too loud. You're making too much noise. Look at me. The loudest one in the room is the weakest one in the room. I told you that. All right? But you trying to be like Nicky Barnes and them?
What's your problem with Nicky, man? I like
Nicky. I ain't got no problem with Nicky. Oh, you like Nicky?
Yeah.
You want to be like Nicky? You want to be super fly, huh? You want to work for him, huh? Yeah. Share a jail cell with him? Maybe cook for him?
He wants to talk to you.
Oh, so now you talking to him about me? What?
No, it ain't
about
like that.
What is it about?
It ain't like that.
Then what
you
is
were
it
talking,
like?
Your name came up.
I told about him, I tell what?
You. I don't know, man. I told him, I tell you.
You know, boy, you... Oh, man. You know, if you wasn't my brother, I'd kill you. You know that, don't you? I'm taking you shopping this week.
That's my guest, Denzel Washington, with Chiwetel Ejiofor in a scene from American Gangster. I remember when I interviewed Michael Caine, he talked about how when you're playing somebody who's very powerful, you shouldn't, like, move around and fidget a lot, gesture a lot, because powerful people don't have to do all that because the people underneath them are hanging on the powerful person's every word and looking for every clue that they can about what his mood is and what's he going to do next and how he's reacting to things. And it seems to me like you're that kind of person in American Gangster. You don't move around a lot. You don't gesture a lot. You've got a lot of power and you know you do. You met Frank Lucas, the person who your role is based on. Was he like that when you met him?
Well, I mean, you know, Gotti moved around a lot. He had a lot of power. I don't know. I personally wouldn't hold any hard, fast rule about who moves around a lot or who doesn't.
Uh-huh.
I've never thought of it that way. The perception of power is power. I think that the perception is established by his violence right at the top of the movie.
Yeah.
So
uh-huh.
You see a guy who's this violent, who can walk down the street, shoot somebody in the head, come back inside and forget. His only question was, what was I talking about before I was interrupted? You know, that's a sociopath.
I really like American Gangster and your performance in it.
Thank you.
Does it ever bother you to play people who aren't role models? Like in life, so many people see you as a role model. Does it bother you? Like in The Great Debaters, you are very role model. You know, you're very ethical.
No, it doesn't bother me. I mean, I do. I'm selfish. I think an artist has to be. I'm not worried about what people think. I'm going to play the parts that I find interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, it bothered me more to be just pigeonholed into doing what people think is ethical, or you know, that's boring to me. I don't pick parts with that in mind, and I just find interesting stories. If it's interesting to me, then I do it.
One of your most non-role model performances is in Training Day, for which you won an Oscar. And mm-hmm. I'd like to play a short scene from that. And in this scene, you're a cop who is really brutal when he wants to be and really nasty. And you're initiating this new rookie cop who's your partner, played by Ethan Hawke. And in this scene, Ethan Hawke has been trying to apprehend two suspects, probably like crack addicts. They've beaten him up. He's finally gotten them handcuffed. You haven't helped him at all. You've basically just been watching. And then after he gets them handcuffed, you kind of move in, insult them, take $60 out of one of their pockets, and you decide not to arrest them. You just leave them there. And Ethan Hawke is mystified. And here's the conversation in the car afterwards.
I'm gonna book that $60, huh? Yeah, go ahead. Book it into evidence, man. Where the suspects though? You could go back and get the suspects.
I don't know where they are. You let them go.
Oh, I let them go.
Yeah, you let them go.
All right, man. You want to run a gun, man? Stay in patrol, okay? This is investigations, all right? Let the garbage men handle the garbage. We're professional anglers, okay? We go after the big fish. Chasing them monkey strong, crackhead motherfuckers. Anyway, you know they'd have killed you without hesitating.
That's why they belong in prison.
For what? They got beat down, they lost their rock, they lost their money. The message from Hillside probably gonna smoke them. I mean, Jesus, what more you want?
I want justice, right?
Is that
I
not mean, justice?
That's street justice.
What's wrong with street justice?
Oh, just let the animals wipe themselves out, right?
God willing. Everybody who looks like them. Unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. The good guys, they die first, right? Those school kids and moms, family men, they don't want to catch the stray bullets in the noodle. To protect the sheep, you gotta catch the wolf. And it takes a wolf to catch a wolf. You understand?
What?
I said you protect the sheep by killing
you.
The wolves. No, you didn't hear me. You listening, but you didn't hear me.
Yeah, all right, whatever.
Yeah, whatever. Whatever the f***.
Let me ask you this. When do you lock anybody up? I mean, it seems like you're pretty busy keeping people out.
What the f*** you talking about? You know what you're talking about, Biddy Boot. Got nothing but between your ears. They build jails because of me. Judges have handed out over 15,000 man years of incarceration time based on my investigations, okay? My record speaks for itself. How many felons have you collared? Huh? Yeah, I rest my case.
That's my guest, Denzel Washington, with Ethan Hawke in a scene from Training Day. And Denzel Washington won an Oscar for his performance in this film. And of course, after what we just heard, since you've said it takes a wolf to catch a wolf, you teach Ethan Hawke how to howl like a wolf. You make him howl. Now, I read that you wanted to make sure that this cop, the character you played, was killed at the end, or that there were real mm-hmm. consequences for his behavior.
Exactly.
Was that not the case when you first saw the script?
No, not to the degree that was satisfying to me. Like I told the director, I couldn't justify him living in the worst way unless he died in the worst way. That the community turns their back on him. He's slapped around, crawling around on the ground like a snake, and basically gets filled full of lead. So we just made it a violent, awful ending for him.
And why did you insist on that?
I just thought that's what he deserved. It was a bit of a cop-out the way the script was, and it smelled like they were looking to do a part two or something.
Uh-huh. There's a scene in this where you're holding two guns on someone and you kind of scrape the guns against each other as if they're two knives that you're sharpening.
Uh-huh.
Was that a bit of business that you came up with when you were holding the guns?
Of course. I mean, you know, it's just rhythm. You know, acting is like music, you know, and you improvise and it's like jazz. You know, there's no rhyme or reason to it. It's not a plan. I just did it. You know, it's just a rhythm. It's just a rhythm. It's like you do. Stanislavski said, you know, you cut 90%. You do all your research and you prepare and then you let it rip, you know, and that's how it is. You know, you practice the music and then you just play it.
Well, let's talk about another film that's very important in your career, and that's Malcolm X, which was directed by Spike Lee. Let's hear a scene from it, and this is a scene in which you're making a speech.
I must emphasize at the outstart that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad is not a politician. So I'm not here this afternoon as a Republican, nor as a Democrat. Not as a Mason, nor as an elk. Not as a Protestant, nor a Catholic. Not as a Christian, nor a Jew. Not as a Baptist, nor a Methodist. In fact, not even as an American. Because if I was an American, the problem that confronts our people today wouldn't even exist.
Now we ain't Americans, huh?
So I have to stand here today as what I was when I was born, a black man. Before there was any such thing as a Republican or a Democrat, we were black. Before there was any such thing as a Mason or an elk, we were black. Before there was any such thing as a Jew or a Christian, we were black people. In fact, before there was any such place as America, we were black. And after America has long passed from the scene, there will still be black people. I'm gonna tell you like it really is. Every election year, these politicians are sent up here to pacify them. They're sent here and set up here by the white man. This is what they do. They send drugs in Harlem down here to pacify us. They send alcohol down here to pacify us. They send prostitution down here to pacify us. Why, you can't even get drugs in Harlem without the white man's permission. You can't get prostitution in Harlem without the white man's permission. You can't get gambling in Harlem without the white man's permission. Every time you break the seal on that liquor bottle, that's a government seal you're breaking. Oh, I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked, bamboozled, led astray, run amok. This is what he does.
That's Denzel Washington in a scene from Malcolm X, for which he was nominated for an Academy Award. When did Malcolm X first enter your consciousness?
I hadn't heard that in about 15 years.
Yeah, what'd you think listening back?
That was interesting. I hadn't heard it in a long time. I hadn't heard it since I'd seen the movie, I guess. Sounded pretty good.
Yeah.
I believed him.
When did Malcolm X enter your consciousness?
I did a play about Malcolm X, actually, about 10, 11 years before that, down at the New Federal Theater in New York City, Henry Street Settlement, a fictional meeting between the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm X. So that's when I really began to dig deep and listen to all the speeches and read his books and study the man. I mean, I knew who he was, but I didn't know who he was until about 1981.
So was there any, like, particular footage, you know, archival footage of Malcolm X that had the biggest impact on how you played him?
No, I don't know. I mean, I couldn't say there's one thing that had the biggest impact, but, you know, I looked at all the footage that there was. I will say that the Schomburg Library, when I first started working on the part, was just the best place. It became my home away from home, and it's a great resource library up in Harlem, 135th Street. And I can't say enough about the work that I did, not just on Malcolm X, but other parts over the years. I would always visit the Schomburg.
Denzel Washington speaking with Terry Gross, recorded in 2008. We'll hear more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's 2008 interview with Denzel Washington, who earned an Oscar nomination for his role in the film Flight.
Let's go to the very early Denzel era. And let's see if our listeners recognize you in this scene. And hint, it's the pilot for a series, a TV series that ran a long time, and you co-starred throughout the run, and it helped make you a star. So here we go, the very early Denzel.
42-year-old white, obese female, 4-day history of right upper quadrant pain, no history of colithiasis or peptic ulcer disease. Mm-hmm.
Has the pain changed with time or position?
No. Physical examination temperature was 39.5 degrees centigrade, blood pressure 130 over 80, no jaunt is present.
Is the abdomen distended?
No, there's a +2/4 tenderness in the right upper quadrant. The liver is 10 centimeters in breadth, 2 centimeters below the right coastal margin. There is a palpable mass just below the liver edge with a positive Murphy sign.
Jesus.
That's your first
scene. I think I mispronounced
scene.
That. I think it's cholelithia. I think it's cholelithiasis. And it sounds like I said cholelithiasis. I believe any doctors out there, if they call in, let me know. I believe it's cholelithiasis.
Well, that's you in your first scene in the pilot of St. Elsewhere. Yeah.
But I remember that cholelithiasis. That's interesting.
That is. I hope you never had it, whatever the heck it is.
I couldn't tell you what it is.
How did you get the part on St. Elsewhere?
I was doing a great play, and I say that because it was, called A Soldier's Play, which went on to become A Soldier's Story. Won the Pulitzer Prize in 1982.
Right, the movie version was A Soldier's Story.
Yeah, movie version was A Soldier's Story. The play was an off-Broadway play in New York. And they came to New York reading actors. I never really wanted to do television. I wanted to do plays and movies, and I didn't want to become well-known for television, but this was an interesting script with many characters, so my agent thought, well, you know, you could get lost amongst the other characters. And so they, to make a long story long, they chose 2 actors, I believe, from New York, myself and David Morse.
What was the audition like?
That was 25 years ago. I don't remember. I guess it was good. I got the part.
You don't remember what you had to do?
Oh, no, actually, I don't. I imagine maybe I read that scene. Maybe that's what I had to do, you know. And did you say that was from the pilot?
It's from the pilot.
That was from, so maybe that's probably what I had to read. That's a perfect example of where your speech training and training in the classics, you know, Shakespearean training comes in to be able to say those lines.
And to rattle off all those words.
All
those medical conditions most people don't know.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Cholelithiasis. I do remember that, though.
So straighten me out on something. When I say your name, should it be Denzel, equal beats on both syllables, or Denzel, more emphasis on the second syllable?
The doctor who delivered my father was named Dr. Denzel. And he had 11 or 12 brothers and sisters, so maybe they were running out of names, and they just named him after the doctor. So his name was pronounced Denzel Hayes Washington Sr. I'm Denzel Hayes Washington Jr. My mother would say Denzel, and both of us would show up. She said, all right, from now on, she says, this is not true, but this is the way I remember it. But she said, from now on, you're Denzel. So I was named Denzel. I was called Denzel, so we would know who she was screaming at.
No, when you were growing up, your mother owned a hair salon?
Yeah.
And your father was a Pentecostal minister who also worked for the water department.
And S. Klein's on the square.
Oh.
He was a night watchman for Klein's.
Klein's
up in
department store? Oh, I see. This
on
is different.
Central Avenue in Yonkers. Yeah, well, the original one was on the square, 14th Street.
On Union Square.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because it used to be called S. Klein's on the square.
Oh.
And so they had one up in Yonkers on Central Avenue, and he was the night man there. And he was a minister.
Did you go to his church?
No, of course not. Yeah. Are you kidding me? All the time. More than I wanted to. Trust me. Used to try to sneak out. Had to go to church.
How often? Once a week or more?
Once. All day Sunday. And then not that, because he worked so much, you know, we didn't have so many services during the week. But I was there all day on Sunday in Mamaroneck.
One last question. Is there a particular movie that meant a lot to you when you were growing up that you watched many times?
Yep.
What would that be?
Wizard of Oz.
Really?
I love that movie. That was the event of the year. To watch, are you kidding me? The Wizard. I was like, turn Bonanza off. The Wizard of Oz is coming on. You know, Bonanza was huge. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, Bonanza was huge. That
yes.
was it. That's what we got to watch. Sunday night, Bonanza, Ed Sullivan Show, then Bonanza. When I sign an autograph now, I always write God bless, and I put my name. And I got that from Red Skelton, because at the end of the Red Skelton show, he would say, good night and God bless. And I was like, I always liked that. So I said, you know, I didn't say when I get famous because I wasn't even thinking about it then. But when I did sign my first autograph, for whatever reason, I thought about that. And so thank you, Red Skelton.
Oh, we do.
And thank you, Bonanza. And thank you, Auntie M.
Did you love the songs? Did you love the songs from the
Wizard of Oz? Are you kidding me? They follow the yellow brick road. Whatever a wizard was. Follow the yellow brick road. You know, I mean, that was you got to remember, they only show that like once a year. What was it? What was the guy's name? Danny Kaye.
Oh, Danny Kaye.
Danny Kaye would
introduce
it. Right. Danny Kaye would introduce it. I mean, we couldn't wait. That was huge. Huge. And then, of course, King Kong.
Oh.
Yeah, because $1 million movie.
They would show
the same movie like 90 times
King
the same
Kong,
week.
Godzilla.
King Kong, Godzilla.
Hunchback of Notre Dame.
I didn't watch that one. You're asking me. This is what I remember.
Great. It's been so much fun to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Bye.
All right. Because.
That is Denzel Washington speaking with Terry in 2008. Washington's won 2 Oscars and earned 6 nominations, the latest for his film Flight, which is now out on DVD. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new film Stoker. This is Fresh Air. The South Korean director Park Chan-wook became famous among violent film aficionados for what's known as his Vengeance trilogy, beginning in 2002 with Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, followed by Old Boy and Lady Vengeance. He makes his English language debut with Stoker, the story of an 18-year-old girl coping with the death of her father and the sudden arrival of an uncle she never knew. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
Stoker has a ripely decadent, creepy, crawly feel that would have gotten under my skin if the tone weren't so arch and the people so ghoulishly remote. It's like a bad Strindberg play with added splatter. But director Park Chan-wook certainly works to make you uncomfortable. Take the early shot in which the teenage girl protagonist, India Stoker, played by Mia Wasikowska, sits in a meadow and muses in voiceover on the subject of free will versus destiny. She says, just as a flower doesn't choose its color, so we don't choose what we are going to be, while draining a blister, in close-up, which you don't often see, at least on screen. Park clearly likes the symbolism. He's saying India has poisons that must be discharged. Wentworth Miller's script has a good, tricky premise, a clear play on the Alfred Hitchcock Thornton Wilder thriller Shadow of a Doubt. In that one, a girl's never-before-seen Uncle Charlie nearly finishes the breathless ingenue off. In Stoker, Uncle Charlie and his niece have deeper ties than are first apparent. Uncle Charlie, played by Matthew Good, arrives on the day of her beloved father's funeral. He was killed in a mysterious car accident on India's 18th birthday. And promptly he makes eyes at both the girl and her brittle mother, Evie, played by Nicole Kidman. And he has some big eyes to make. He's like Dwight Fry's bug-eating mental patient in the original Dracula. I don't think he blinks in the movie. A long, fairly tedious stretch features Charlie and Evie whispering and wandering off while India stares balefully, the atmosphere pregnant with suppressed violence and eroticism. Then Charlie sits opposite India and passes her a goblet of red wine from which she drinks.
What do you want from me?
To be friends.
We don't need to be friends. We're family.
Family is a loaded term in Stoker. Just what does Charlie see in India? And why do people like the longtime servant and a visiting aunt played by Jackie Weaver keep disappearing? You can see the ending limping toward you from a mile away, like a particularly slow zombie. Director Park Chan-wook made a big noise at film festivals over the last decade with Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance, Sympathy for Lady Vengeance, and Old Boy, but they weren't mainstream hits. They were too cruel. For Park, vengeance is, as you can imagine, fraught with peril, the drive for retribution, turning even good people inside out. So by the time the revenge comes, it's too ghastly to be satisfying. I used to think he was getting at something serious, but in retrospect, wonder if he wasn't just bludgeoning us into submission. The vile little chamber horror Stoker certainly has nothing on its mind. That said, there always seems like something's going on in Mia Wasikowska's mind. Her eyes usher you into India's inner world, with its battle between girlish longing and the impatience to move on and be what she really is, whatever that might be. It's a richer performance than the movie deserves. As her mother, Nicole Kidman doesn't rise above the material in the same way. Her face is too tight a mask. Matthew Good has a more interesting mask, so squarely on the border between angelic and satanic, he makes you remember that Satan was an angel. But it's a long time to stare at a guy with only one expression. We wait around for the inevitable violence, listening to faux classical piano duets provided by Philip Glass and wallowing in the movie's malignant elegance. Stoker has nothing to do with the author of Dracula, Bram, but the name is meant to evoke him, and the undead would be the movie's best audience.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from RDO, a digital music service allowing listeners to discover millions of songs and listen everywhere, RDIO.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, supporter of the Cy Sims School of Business and Executive MBA program at Yeshiva University. And from the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. This is NPR.
People are living under the illusion that the American dream is working for them, and it's rigged by the guys at the tippy top.
Laura Dern plays a naive whistleblower on the HBO series Enlightened. On the next Fresh Air, her co-creator and co-star Mike White tells us about the season finale. Join us.